I don't have a girly drink in front of me, but I've got a gin and tonic. I got a gin and tonic.
Oh, seriously? So. Great. I wish I had my girly drink at my fingertips, yeah. But, you know, I don't know that that would make for the best interview.
Or it would make for... Exactly.
Yes, I do get a little punchy.
Hey there. Welcome to Beer, Beats, and Business, where the art of conversation is back in business. Now pull up a chair next to Dee Fish. He's a speaker, author, business coach, basically all-around professional talker. And he's chatting with some of today's top entrepreneurs, authors, artists, executives, you name it. They might discuss business technology or what's playing on their headphones. Who knows where the conversation will take them? So grab a glass and join us on Beer, Beats, and Business.
Any place you notice that you're feeling resistance, overwhelm, tired, lost, take a moment, pause, take a breath. Notice if you're attached to anything. Often we have those feelings when we're attached to something. We're attached to something being the way it should be, and it's just not going the way we want it to be. Notice those attachments and let them go. Just make that choice in that moment and say, okay, it's not going that way. That's not important. I'm okay. And let it go.
That was one of my favorite introverts, Beth Bielo. Beth is a business coach, speaker. She runs an amazing podcast called The Introvert Entrepreneur. And she's the author of a book, The Introvert Entrepreneur, How to Amplify Your Strengths and Create Success on Your Own Terms. I was really excited to have Beth on the show today because, believe it or not, I actually have some introverted tendencies and I always like to talk shop with another introvert. My name is David J.P. Fisher, but most people just call me D. Fish. I'm an author, speaker, and business coach who focuses mostly on helping people who are in the sales and business world navigate professional relationships in the 21st century. Most importantly, though, I'm going to be your host today on Beer, Beats, and Business. So let's get it started. Beth, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you, David?
I am living the dream.
Yes, I can hear that in your voice.
Is that what that
yeah.
is? I thought it was just some seasonal allergies.
No, no, I hear the conviction, the strength of living that dream.
That's awesome. I always get confused when people call me David. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. That's me. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
You've joined a very small group of my mom and my fiance.
That sounds a little intimate for...
No, that's all right. You can call me David. You know, as I said, just don't call me late for dinner,
okay.
You know?
Okay, yep.
That's a horrible joke, and part of me dies every time I say that.
I'm not sure if I can actually go on now. So,
I think you can make it. I think you can make
I'll do my best.
So here's our first question.
Yes.
So you just released a book, and we're going to get to that in a little bit. But has putting a book out into the world made you more or less introverted?
Boy, it's kind of both. Yes.
Okay.
Let's put it this way. Yes. It's made me a bit more introverted in some ways. And in some ways, it's allowed me to play the introvert card because when you specialize in working with introverts, it's, you know, something I can pull out and say, well, time to go. I need to introvert. Or they'll say, you know, they'll pass me if I'm sitting at a conference and I'm sitting by myself and working on something. They'll go, oh, there she is introverting. So it gives me like this out, which is awesome.
Nice.
But on a more, you know, sort of serious level and personal level, you know, there's nothing like publishing a book that raises all sorts of, you know, if you ever feel vulnerable, you know, all of those vulnerability issues and the consequences of being seen and putting yourself out there and putting out your thoughts and, you know, those things, that all of that more out there activity, that more exposure, I think in some ways has caused me not necessarily to be more introverted, but to be more kind of fiercely protective of my introverted side because I
sure.
know that I need that downtime in order to have the capacity to handle the vulnerability and to handle the being out there. And I would say at the same time, though, this whole process has brought out my extroverted side a little bit more. And really what I would say is it has made it more accessible. like I'm, it's easier to tap into. I don't have to work as hard to get there. And,
okay.
And I trust it a little bit more. Like doing interviews like this, you know, I think like 6 years ago, I would have, you know, had the questions and then probably literally typed out my answers. And,
okay.
And I wouldn't have necessarily read them word for word, but I would have only felt comfortable going into it if I had completely thought through everything that I was going to say. And now, you know, through this process of both writing the book and promoting the book, I've had to become more comfortable with what I consider to be kind of an extroverted trait, which is being able to, you know, think and speak out loud, think out loud, basically.
Well, that makes sense. Well, and that's so an interesting question I have for you is, how does one who, I mean, you built your business around working with introverts, mm-hmm. and you know, boldly claim yourself at one as well, and then you go into a line of work where you deal with people.
Yes. Yes.
Right? It's like you're not an accountant. You're not a computer programmer. You, as a coach and a speaker and now an author and putting yourself out there, like, how do you, and I know when I was on your podcast, we talked about this a little bit, how do you manage the energy of that? Like, what has allowed you to be an introvert and still go out there and really engage with people?
I think first it's been about understanding what it means to be an introvert, which is where I gain and drain my energy. So it doesn't have to do with my social skills. It doesn't have to do with if I'm good with people or not and that sort of thing. So understanding and also just talking about it and continuing to evolve in my understanding as I share with others and they share with me. What's happened is that I've just become clearer about what kind of introvert I am and how to honor that part of myself, mostly by being clear on what I say yes to and what I say no to, and,
okay.
and really owning my introvert time. Like I make no bones about the fact that I take regular naps. You know, I'm not one of these entrepreneurs that's like, I'm going to work 20 hours a day and I'm never going to sleep. And
Okay, time out. Naps are awesome.
Naps are
so
the
I know I just wanted to defend like. I always love when people have to, like, defend napping.
And I don't defend it, you know?
No, it's awesome.
It's awesome. It is, for me, especially as an introvert, it's like my ultimate restorative time. It's like your computer every once in a while, you know, if you leave your computer on for too long, it starts getting wonky, right? Programs get slow, it gets confused, it starts crashing. Well, that's what happens to me, and I think that's what happens to a lot of introverts. It's like we've just got the bandwidth is maxed out, and so a nap is the ultimate way to just, like, shut down for a little while. And so the first piece of furniture I bought when I leased an office outside my house was a napping couch. Because literally, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, it hadn't occurred to me right away, like, oh, if I'm not working from home, where am I going to nap? So before anything else, I got the couch, and it is an awesome napping couch, and I use it, and I do not apologize for that, because it is an integral part of what makes me able to have the energy to continue to show up and work with people and be my best for my clients and do interviews like this. No apologies.
We talked about spontaneity earlier. Mm-hmm. I think some people, when they think about introversion, think that they're shy. And sometimes I see shyness, not in everybody, but in some people, it's kind of a lack of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that lack of confidence comes from projecting into the future. Well, what if I say the wrong thing,
yeah.
and then everybody will hate me later? You're like, okay, just relax. You know,
is that really going to happen? You know,
probably not.
Right.
One of my favorite sayings right now is, we would worry a lot less about what people think about us if we realize how little people think
exactly.
about us.
Exactly. That is such a brilliant quote, because it's true. We're all sitting here thinking, what do they think of me? What do they think of me? And when you think about that, that means nobody's thinking of you. They're thinking about themselves.
Right. We're all in our own little world.
Uh-huh.
That, I mean, that's something that I've always used, you know, as an entrepreneur, is just this idea of, and it's taken a while to get here, and I'm still working on it every day, that you just try stuff, because in the end, it's really not going to kill you. And it's not the end of the world,
right.
And nobody's going to die, and in about 6 months, nobody will remember your big screw-up, even if you have one.
Exactly. They're not even going to remember if you change your business name 3 times in a year. I mean, honestly, I mean, you might want to be careful and not do that, but I guess the point is, you know, the things that we think are going to be huge and memorable, and we better get it right or else everybody's going to think we're a failure. the truth is nobody is thinking about it as much as we are. Nobody is remembering it. And so to give yourself what I call space and grace to be able to just put stuff out there and see what happens, see what works, and listen to yourself as you do that, so that eventually you land in that authentic place and you do find that thing, whatever it is, that you stick with, and then people will, you know, they'll be sure to remember it because you will have so much conviction behind it. They can't help it.
Right. I'm laughing because I was just having a conversation with someone about naming a business.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, here's the deal. You put a lot of thought and effort into it and then realize it just doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, because, you know, I've seen entrepreneurs like just struggle with this and they're like, oh, I've got to think of the perfect mm-hmm. name and it's got to say everything. And I just look at them and go, Google.
Yeah.
Some person just came up with Google.
Right.
That's what we're going to name our company.
You know.
Right. Yahoo. Like, really?
Yeah.
And you know, now they're household words. And it's not because the name was perfect. It was because of everything that was created in the organization.
Yeah.
And then just the name was there. So it's this really strange balance of, again, pay attention, work hard, and then just be like, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, and so kind of along those same lines. So, you know, you've obviously gone out on your own. You're doing your own thing. What has been one of the biggest kind of, not challenges, but just even surprises for you in going out and doing your own thing and building this business?
I'm going to, you know, I think about this from an introvert entrepreneur's perspective, right? There are lots of things that are surprising about being an entrepreneur that, that would be universal. But I think for me as an introvert in particular, you would think that working from home would be ideal, right? You don't have
sure.
to deal with other people. You've got your own space. You can be in your jammies. You can have your pets, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so I thought, yeah, this is going to be fabulous. I get to work from home and do my own thing and my own schedule. And what I found is about a year into it, I was like, I need to get out of here. I need to be around other people, which you wouldn't necessarily expect to hear from an introvert. And,
right.
and I would qualify that with, I need to be around other people in that I still have a private office, but I'm going into an office building. I'm riding an elevator with other people. I have people around me in other offices who are also working, not doing the dishes or, you know, trying to decide to sort their socks because they don't feel like doing whatever it is that they have to do for their business. So
right.
being in that, being still being independent, autonomous, and in a private space, but yet feeling part of the fabric of a business community. So I don't think I expected that when I first started, because you think, oh, this is kind of a no-brainer. Of course you'd work from home. But
sure.
like after that year, I was just like, I have got to get out of here. And so it's been important also, not just in the getting me out and connecting with people, and also there's sort of the byproduct of that is, you know, if I go downstairs and I go to the coffee shop, I might run into somebody I know. Right?
Right.
And that wouldn't happen if I was just working from home, because chances of me just going out randomly, you know, may or may not happen. But so it puts you out into the world while you still have, you know, control and independence. But it's also been really good for boundaries. You know, my husband and I, we don't have children, but our home is, you know, it's our sanctuary. It's where we connect. It's where we unwind. And my husband would come home and I'd be sitting on the couch or at my desk with my laptop. And he would have already transitioned or be ready to transition out of work mode. And I may be right in the thick of writing a blog post.
Right.
And so he feels like, the way he put it was like, I feel like I'm walking into your office and interrupting your work when I come home. And I'm so glad that we had really honest and loving conversations about it, because it has been very that has caused a big shift, I think, in the way we both feel about home and work, by me taking it outside of the home and having that boundary. That doesn't mean I still don't work from home sometimes, like I'm working from home today on this beautiful Friday.
Sure.
And it doesn't mean that I don't work when he's here, but we have a much clearer understanding and communication about it. And I respect that we want to keep home as home. And so I try to confine my work as much as possible to doing it outside the home, even if that means on a weekend, I leave the house and go to a coffee shop and work for a couple hours.
Well, that's what I was thinking, right?
Yeah.
It's the coffee house phenomenon. Yeah. A bunch of, you know, 30 people on laptops all working, just not with each other.
Exactly. And they're probably all introverts.
Yeah. Well, what I would say is, you know, you talk kind of about something that's unique to you. I actually don't think it is that unique.
No,
I've talked to a lot of people who really, you know, need to be, as you said, like around people, but still in your own space.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I think coffee houses right now are so packed, or you're getting, you know, co-working spaces and this whole idea of, and, you know, I'll use myself as an example. I've got a great home office and, you know, it's its own separate space.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely days where I'm like, I'm going to go to the coffee house.
Exactly.
Just because if I'm at home all day and talk to nobody but the cats, I'm going to get a little wonky.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. You start getting way up into your own head, you know, and I find myself much more easily distracted. You know, there's something, it's odd, but sometimes I find it's much easier for me to focus at a place like a coffee house where maybe there's a little bit of that kind of white noise and movement and other people that helps me to just kind of hone in on what I'm doing. It's kind of a strange thing, but I know that I'm not alone in that for sure.
Oh, not at all. You said something about, you know, kind of home being a sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And so for you and your husband, it's a chance you kind of come home and you separate from the outside world. I think kind of in reverse, I know that's something that helps me sometimes, especially when I'm writing, for example. I can write at home, but it's horrible. Mm-hmm. I just sit there and stare at the screen. But it's very different when you walk into that coffee house and you're like, okay. Like for me, there's Brothers K, which is my local place on the street. I love it. I go, now I'm in work mode.
Exactly.
Right?
Right.
This is my creative space. And I think that can be very important, having those rituals.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you look forward to maybe getting your favorite drink or a snack or, you know, something that feels like you're taking care of yourself and at the same time taking care of your business.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. So I want to switch gears a little bit. And so I want to ask you about being a classical musician, but first, everyone, you are listening in to Beer, Beats, and Business. I am your host, D-Fish. If you want to reach out to me, please shoot me a tweet at D-Fish Rockstar. If you have an idea for a guest or a topic we should cover, please share it. We've got a lot of great guests coming up, so here on Season 2, make sure you're subscribing. And today, in talking about great guests, I'm talking with Beth Below. Beth is a guide for introverts who want to amplify their strengths and create sustainable businesses. She's an amazing coach. She's a speaker. She's a great podcaster, one of my inspirations. She's also the author of The Introvert Entrepreneur, Amplify Your Strengths and Create Success on Your Own Terms. And Beth, what is the best way for people to connect with you or just to find out more information about you?
Well, my home base is my website, theintrovertentrepreneur.com, and I've been stepping up my activity on Twitter, where you can find me at Introvert Coach. There's a thriving community on Facebook if you look for The Introvert Entrepreneur, and also stepping up my activity on LinkedIn, and I love to connect with people who have a, you know, shared interest and some things in common. So you can find me there under Beth Below.
Awesome. All right, so classical music.
Yeah.
You are a classical musician. That was going to be a career path. Talk to me about this, because I am fascinated.
Yeah. Well, it all started back in sixth grade, because that's when you, or was it fifth grade? Fifth or sixth grade? Fifth grade. Oh my gosh, I'm getting old. Fifth grade.
We can't afford a fact checker, so you're fine.
Good. Excellent. Then, you know, my 24 years on this earth are fresh. So I think it was back in fifth grade, and that was when everybody got to choose, like, do you want to join the band? You know, and you, something about it just really appealed to me. My father had always tried to get me interested in different instruments. Like, they got me a violin at one point and a guitar, and he took me to the opera, and we had classical music albums. You know, my favorite was the Tchaikovsky 1812 Overture and Smetana La Valse, you know, and these other things. And so I kind of grew up exposed to classical music. And one of these turning points was, I'm sure a lot of people will remember this, or maybe, again, this is aging me and putting me more than 24, but I believe it was the 1984 before Olympics or maybe it was before that when Torval and Dean did their ice dancing routine to Ravel's Bolero. And I think that was the moment, even just like saying it right then, I get this little chill. And even feel a little choked up because nice. It was so incredibly beautiful. The ice dancing itself, but the music just so captured me. So when that fifth grade opportunity came up for, and it had to have been before 1984 because that would have been, I think it was more like 1978 or something like that. But, so when fifth grade came up and you got to choose, you know, if you could be in the band, I really desperately wanted to play flute because my best friend was playing flute. And okay. I heard that when you got to be a senior in high school, if you were in the band, you got to go on a band trip. So,
oh, yeah, of course.
My motivation was purely social. You know, we couldn't afford a flute, but my father found a clarinet advertised in the Penny Saver for $40. We went, we visited, we talked them down to $35.
Okay, all right.
Bargain. And I went home with my first clarinet and made horrible sounds for a little while, but then my overachiever type A personality kicked in, and within 2 weeks I was first chair. And then I continued to, you know, it, that kind of, it
that,
brought out.
That fifth grade first chair didn't know it was coming.
I know.
You just took it over. I love it.
I just, yeah, I was just like, you know, it, like I had been like set free somehow, you know, there was something in my identity that came forward. And so I continued all the way through, of course, you know, junior high, high school, college and graduate school. So I have a bachelor's and a master's in music performance in clarinet. And it was about halfway through my master's program when I realized I was spending more time in the library than I was in the practice room, which is not necessarily a formula for success as a classical musician. And I also realized I loved music too much to be a musician. I found myself kind of surrounded by people who were extremely driven, extraordinarily talented, loved music, but also, in my estimation had, this drive and this level of perfectionism that kind of spoiled it for me. That's why I say I love it too much to do it professionally, because I thought I just don't know if I want to go that far. And I think it's great that I recognized that early on, or else I would have probably been miserable. And it was kind of tough because being that classical musician, being the best equals clarinet, you know, that was my identity for so long. That's how I related to the world. That's who my friends were.
Right.
And so when I had that realization halfway through my graduate program, it was fortunately I knew what I wanted to shift to. And so I shift to arts administration, because I realized that, you know, I kind of had a business brain as well as a music brain, and I could combine those two things. So I knew where I was going to land, but at the same time, there was still something of a struggle to let go of or release such a firm hold on that classical musician identity and embrace a new identity. And so, you know, you say you were, you are, you know, I still consider myself a musician. I always will be, even if I never touch my clarinet again, because it's just part of who I am. And it's something that's, you know, in my heart and in my soul. But I am grateful that I had that awareness and was able to kind of, you know, shift gears. And I've continued to shift gears multiple times over the years. And my classical music training, I think, is part of what makes me a good speaker, what makes me, you know, a good coach. I picked up so many habits and just ways of being in the world and ability to take feedback, an ability to be on stage and take criticism and to be in the spotlight, all of those things, I use them every day. So that's in a nutshell, the classical musician story.
That's awesome. But I think you're right, just identifying what you really are getting from an activity and if it's kind of worth putting more into it or just letting it be what it is.
Yeah, and to be okay with that. I don't consider myself a failed musician or anything close to that. It's more just I have a different relationship with it than I did before, and I'm exceedingly grateful every day that I had that experience. And part of the irony is that I ended up marrying a musician, basically.
Well, that's because we're awesome, you know, right? I mean, let's face it.
I know, because musicians are awesome, you know. And he makes his living doing what I thought I was going to be doing. He's the executive director of a symphony orchestra. So I thought at some point I was either going to be in a symphony orchestra or I was going to be the executive director of one. I'm neither, but I'm married to one. And that brings it into my life, and also in a very satisfying way. And it makes for a really cool partnership between me and my husband, because I know exactly, you know, what he's dealing with every
right.
day. I know what his life is like, and I can be there to support him.
So did the classical music, you know, that training, and you said it had a lot of application to today. So when you were writing the book, did that help? Like that kind of discipline or in rigor that you need, were you able to kind of tap into that, or what was the writing process like for you? I'm always curious when I talk to other authors.
I think it's about where the transferability was in that receiving feedback.
Mm.
So as a musician,
okay.
you know, you're always, especially when you're a student, you're having, you know, private lessons every week, you're doing master classes, you have juries, you're giving recitals, you're always being judged. Right.
Right.
Whether it's by your teachers or by your fellow musicians. And honestly, audiences judge you every time.
Sure.
They're applauding or not, or shouting or heckling or whatever. But I think, you know, the all of those years of being vulnerable, putting myself out there for criticism was a great training ground for writing the book, because the book is, it's like, it's private until it's not.
Right.
It's, you know, you're writing it, and then at some point, if it's actually going to be a real book, it has to be seen by other people. It, otherwise, it's just a journal.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It goes from journaling to writing the moment somebody else sees it.
Exactly. And so what I ended up doing was, as I started the first draft, you know, I knew from the beginning that this book had potential to be attractive to a traditional publisher. And so I really took the time to have the discipline and kind of up my game and say, okay, if this is going to be worthy of that, which I know it is, then I need to, you know, take things to that higher level of work. So I hired a freelance editor from the beginning to work with me on that first draft so that I started the feedback loop. And because I was getting feedback from her on a consistent basis, that added accountability as well, but it made my writing grow stronger with each time. So just like in a master class, if you're a musician, you play the piece, the teacher gives you feedback, and if you're really good, you incorporate that feedback the next time you play.
Right.
And so I found it the same way with the writing. I would challenge myself as my editor was giving me feedback to start to incorporate and think ahead. You know, almost like, what would Lori think? You know, how would Lori read this? What would Lori say?
How would I get yelled at after writing?
Yeah.
Funny you say that, because I have that exact same experience. And I think pretty much any creative person does. And it, even thinking back to music, you know, my band recorded a couple albums way back in the day. We're not going to talk about how long I've been on the earth either. But I knew that they were good, and we never became really famous or rich or anything, because I still like to listen to it sometimes. And some, and my fiance is actually coming to me like, what are you listening to? I'm like, oh, it's my band. And she's like,
yeah.
Really? I'm like, yeah, it's a good tune. Share with me that you're reading On Writing by Stephen King, and that's actually one of my favorite books on writing. What's the biggest thing you've pulled out of your reading so far from that?
Yeah, I really resonated with, and I'm guessing a lot of people who've read this book pulled this out, is when he's describing his first official writing job with a small local paper where he's writing sports reports.
Yep.
And he brings the first piece to his editor, and the editor is sort of, you know, slashing and burning it, and gives him the advice that you write with the door closed and you rewrite with the door open.
Yep.
So your first draft and the way you're starting it, you are putting it all out there. You're saying everything you want to say, all of that. And you're not necessarily worried about what are other kind of people going to think. So you kind of stay with your own voice. But then when you rewrite, when you go back and you edit and you fine tune, you take your audience into account and you start to sort of hear it and read it through their eyes. And that's where, you know, where something that is maybe average writing can become great writing. So that piece really stood out to me. And then I'm appreciating, and I noticed that, you know, some of the criticisms on, you know, Amazon say, well, you know, a lot of this is really super basic. And one of the things I appreciate about as he gets into the on writing part and past the memoir part is that he is getting back to basics. Like, he's reminding us of some really simple fundamental things that if you do pay attention to them are going to make your writing really strong. And you have to learn the rules in order to break the rules. So I'm appreciating his, at first I was a little impatient, like, oh, come on, you know, let's get on with talking about imperatives or, you know, whatever. Nobody remembers that stuff anyway. But I'm appreciating that he's kind of taking us back and saying there are some basic structures and rules that are beneficial to follow. And when you kind of outline the sandbox that you're playing in, you can build any kind of sandcastle you want in that. And he's proof of that because his writing breaks all sorts of rules.
Yeah.
And is so imaginative and so creative and colorful, and it's so distinctively his voice. And so I see his writing as a direct manifestation of the advice he's giving. So he's definitely walking the talk, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. One of the things I really liked that helped me with my writing was just the idea that you don't wait for inspiration.
Right.
You just show up, and he talks about a schedule, I know, in the book. But he's just like, yeah. No, I show up, and I think it was in the mornings. He's like, I write every morning. And sometimes I get 50 words, and sometimes 500.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes none of it's usable, and sometimes it's brilliant. But just this, you know, people always ask me if I enjoy writing. And I'm like, there's a great quote. And again, I always forget who says wise things. This is definitely not mine. But I don't like writing. I like having written.
Exactly. Oh, I love it. Yeah.
And so somebody brilliant said that, and I'm sorry I can't attribute it. But
that's great. We'll have to find out who.
Yeah, but that was something I definitely pulled out, is just this idea where, you know, and since then, thinking about music or just really any art, that anything that's creative, mm-hmm. we sometimes mistake art and we think about inspiration. And you really like what's good writing? It's another quote I love is, if you just write the first draft and that's it, that's just typing. Mm-hmm. Editing is writing. You know, like, it is just slogging through and trying to make it good. That's what actually being a writer is.
Exactly. And being an observer, I mean, you're reminding me of the other thing I appreciate, especially about the memoir part of on writing, is when he's talking about how he got the inspiration for the character of Carrie, or, you know, where The Shining ideas came from. You know, he's showing us that, you know, it's the keen observer that notices things that other people don't, and maybe connects some dots that other people don't, and then takes them to that next place.
Yeah.
And that's where the magic is. So it's like we all have that inspiration at our disposal. It's just, are you awake to it? Are you paying attention?
Right, exactly.
And then doing something with it.
But I always like to end every episode with the same question, and it's this.
I know.
If you could give someone a tip to make today a little better, what would it be?
Any place you notice that you're feeling resistance, overwhelm, tired, lost, take a moment, pause, take a breath. Notice if you're attached to anything. Often we have those feelings when we're attached to something. Or attached to something being the way it should be, and it's just not going the way we want it to be. Notice those attachments and let them go. Just make that choice in that moment and say, okay, it's not going that way. That's not important. I'm okay. And let it go. It's a very simple thing. You can do it every day. You can make that choice every minute, and it's something you'll work on for the rest of your life. so that's what I have to offer.
That is perfect. Thank you for sharing. And Beth, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
As always, thanks for stopping by. You can find show notes and links to the topics in this episode at beerbeatsandbusiness.com. You can also share this episode through social media and leave reviews through iTunes, Stitcher, or any of your favorite podcasting services. This episode, like all others, is brought to you by our regulars over at Patreon. If you'd like to be one of the people with your own spot at the bar, we'd love to have you. Visit patreon.com/B3 and become a regular today. Want to get in on the conversation? Easy. Send DFish a message on Twitter at DFishRockstar. And we'll save a spot for you at the bar for the next Beer, Beats, and Business.
I'm DFish. Thanks for joining us today.
Sure, there were things that I would improve or add, or the ways my thinking has evolved. But as it stands, I'm like, yeah, that's a pretty good book.
Nice.